Today is Wednesday. It's April 30th, 2025. It's 2:40 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams. And once again, this is the Mincing Rascals podcast, the podcast for people who care about Chicago. You can hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Marge Helper, an award-winning journalist turned communications consultant, political consultant, community activist, doing what I can to challenge authority more than ever.
I'm Kate Plies, former reporter, Chicago reporter and columnist, now doing the Chicago History website on Substack, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
I'm Eric Zorn, also on Substack, former Tribune columnist. You can find me at the Picayune Sentinel.
Austin Berg's going to be joining us shortly. He's doing some other media. I do want to talk about Trump's 100 days, the first 100 days, and a few local issues like banning plastic bags and styrofoam containers, and would you turn in a $100 bill flitting around Oak Park if you knew 300,000 of them were missing? And who's in more danger right now, Bill Belichick or Jordan Hudson? These are burning questions of the day. But let's start with this one. What is least likely and most likely to happen? J.B. Pritzker becomes United States president. Rod Blagojevich becomes a U.S. senator. Our lieutenant governor, Juliana Stratton, becomes a U.S. senator. Which of those is most likely to happen, Marge?
I would rate Juliana Stratton as U.S. senator. I think she's got a leg up. That doesn't mean she's going to, but you've given me a choice of three, so I put her at the top.
Do you think it's more than 50-50?
Slightly.
Slightly more likely.
Moment, it's a little early to make a call. You know, I'd put her a little above 50%, but I wouldn't put her too close to 100. I think she's got a leg up right now. That puts her in the 50 to 60 range.
Well,
but there's a lot to happen before anyone will know.
Like other people join the race. She's the only one that's announced. But it's interesting what's happened with the endorsements she's already garnered. We'll get to that in a minute. Where are you, Kate? What's most or least likely of those three scenarios?
I have to agree with Marge. I don't think she is a shoo-in. I think the way you put it last week, Eric, I'd have to be a fool to predict who would win. And so I will go ahead and predict. If I was going to be a complete fool and predict who would win out of the probable contenders right now, I would go with Raj Krishnamurthy, whose name I probably mispronounced. But of the three that you're talking about, definitely Stratton. I mean, she definitely has a leg up. She has a leg up. But
would you say, Kate, that Rod Blagojevich becoming a U.S. senator is the least likely, right? I think we would all agree on that.
Yes.
I weigh whether...
But I think he's going to run. I think he'll run in the primary. And who knows what happens after that. I think we're going to be stuck seeing a lot of him.
Yeah.
I put him last, but I don't think Pritzker's going to be president either.
No.
Where are you, Mr. Zorn?
30%. That Juliana Stratton will be elected senator, 10% that J.B. Pritzker will be elected president, 0% that Rod Blagojevich will be the next U.S. senator from Illinois.
Blagojevich can run for federal office. The law in Illinois is he can't run for state or local. Am I right about that?
Well, yeah, you can run as a convicted felon, you can run for federal office. I don't know if you consider that a loophole or not. I could argue either way on that. But yes, in state law, it was part of Blagojevich's impeachment that he was not allowed to run for any state offices anymore, so that his pardon by Trump doesn't even erase the felony conviction. Now, he stands unconvicted now because of his pardon, so that's sort of a moot point. But when he was impeached, the General Assembly said he could no longer run for state office, which includes local municipal offices and, you know, state rep and so on, city councils, that kind of thing.
I'm interested in the exact percentages that Eric gave us. Did you poll yourself like 1,000 times over 2 or 3 days and come up with those exact percentages?
I ran all kinds of scenarios and came up with that. No, I think that I object to J.B. Pritzker and Tammy Duckworth leaping out of the gate to endorse Juliana Stratton before anybody else even got into the race. It looked like just a ham-handed attempt to clear the field, put their thumb on the scale. And their endorsements don't tend to mean a whole lot in politics anymore, but money still does mean something. And J.B. Pritzker has a lot of it. I think it's why he's being considered seriously as a candidate for president. He could self-fund almost a candidacy for president right now. Juliana Stratton, if she's got Pritzker's endorsement, okay, but Pritzker's money will really go a long way in helping her. Raja Krishnamoorthy has about $20 million in his campaign fund, which goes some distance toward challenging the kind of money that Pritzker would put into to a race. And again, and at some point, money doesn't matter, right? I mean, look at Michael Bloomberg, for instance, you know, who spent millions and tens of millions of dollars on his presidential campaign and got zero delegates out of that. So money's not everything, but money is important. And I'm afraid that this was going to scare off some candidates like Robin Kelly, like Lauren Underwood. These are both congresswomen from this area. Probably wouldn't scare off Rahm Emanuel if he wanted to run. He's got a pretty prolific fundraising apparatus. But I don't like the idea of these people coming in and saying, like, here you go, here's your candidate. And I would venture to say that of the people in this country, in this state, who know Juliana Stratton's record, which is not a long record, by the way, it's close to zero. She was a state rep for a minute, and then she became Pritzker's running mate. And so what exactly has she done? Who is she exactly? I got to say, I didn't pay that much attention to her. She's a lieutenant governor. The state is as
there's nothing for her to do.
Nothing official for her to do, right? I mean, it's
exactly right.
So this idea that we've chosen her, voters fall in line, I don't like. But that doesn't poison me against Stratton. I might end up voting for her. I don't know. But I would like to hear the case made by Lauren Underwood, by Raja Krishnamoorthy, Robin Kelly. When I foolishly made my prediction, Alexei Janulis, the Secretary of State, who I think is an accomplished and impressive public figure.
Well, that's still a possibility. You're not discounting. Did he say he wasn't going to run, Alexei?
Oh, no, I don't think no one else has said anything yet, but I can imagine him saying, well, you know, maybe I'll wait and run for governor if Pritzker doesn't run, or I'll just bide my time.
Does it feel to you all like Kamala Harris being anointed as the Democrat candidate?
When
now, if J.B. Pritzker with his money and Tammy Duckworth, the other U.S. senator, said that Juliana Stratton should be the next U.S. senator, outside of Dick Durbin himself, those are the two most important endorsements, I would imagine, statewide. So it does sort of seem like, Eric, they're just sort of setting the table for us. Here it is. Because it's not going to be a Republican, probably. So there's your next U.S. senator. Ta-da!
I agree. They've chilled the field. And we may not see some people jump in who would have if they felt like it was more wide open. With the larger electorate, not with people like us, it probably isn't going to make any difference in terms of Stratton's chances later. It just irritates us and people who are paying that much attention early on in the field. But I mean, she was a state representative for 7 months. That's nothing. So this is somebody, you know what? I love the rest of her story, right? It's great. She grew up in Bronzeville. Lots of people are going to identify with the fact that she says that she got into politics after the experience of being the main caretaker for her mother with Alzheimer's. So that's all well and good and interesting. But I want to see a little time actually learning how to function in a legislature before you run for Senate.
That nothing experience is about the same as Barack Obama's before he ran for U.S. Senate.
I was thinking about that, yeah.
He was in the Illinois State Legislature for quite a while before he ran for U.S. Senate. However, he was only a U.S. Senator for not even a year before he started getting together a campaign for president.
Mm-hmm. Still, I think Stratton may be better known in other communities. You're right about her Alzheimer's work. I think she's also done a lot of work in the areas of social justice and gun reform and other areas that may have given her exposure to communities. But I also agree with you, Kate. The early endorsements are fodder for us to talk about. but I don't think they do a whole lot until the money, until we see the money.
The voters aren't paying attention yet. So.
Well, yeah, it's true. It's true. People are snapping off their podcast apps right now. but I do want to draw a distinction between what happened with Kamala Harris and what's happened here. What's happened here is that some big Democrats have tried to put the thumb on the scale for Stratton, but the voters will get to weigh in. And with Kamala Harris, I think I still think it was a mistake for Joe Biden to stick around as long as he did. I think it would have been better for the Democrats to have had a good, robust primary season. It would have helped. It would have helped whoever emerged, whether it was Harris or somebody else. And it would have, I don't think that voters really recoiled at the idea of Kamala Harris as being this person who they didn't have a choice about nominating. But I think we all understood that they had to act quickly and that you couldn't have run a fitting primary season. I mean, Biden stepped down. When was the date? It was late July.
I got to disagree with you here, though, Eric, because I really strongly felt this way about it, that they should have had some kind of mini primary. I was more sensitive to it when I was reading articles about it, but many people were quoted as having that feeling that she had stepped in ahead of everybody else without a contest. And I am currently reading the first book that's out on, and I forget the exact title, on the way Biden's condition was concealed from the public for so long. A big part of that whole scenario was that Obama and Pelosi both wanted a little short primary season, you know, just a few weeks, whatever. They wanted to push for that. Instead, Biden very quickly, not automatically, but he very quickly did endorse Kamala Harris. And he did that as a big F you to Obama because he was still so mad at Barack Obama for kind of pushing him and away from running for president in 2016.
Are rehashing what happened and how we lost this last race isn't going to stack up to what we have to say about the 100 days.
We'll see. I
feels like 100 years, but it's only 100 days that we've had with Trump so far. We got what we got, and we got to deal with what is happening in this country today is my feeling.
You're talking now about the first 100 days of the Trump administration.
I am. Feels like 100 years. It's 100 days.
Incidentally, you just heard the pitching, and that was Austin Berg joining us from the Illinois Policy Institute. We know you were doing some other media there, Mr. Berg. How are you? Welcome to the show.
Doing well, and I apologize for my infidelity to the Mincing Rascals. I was called early this morning for a national thing.
Was it Fox again?
It was with Guy Benson, who does a radio show for Fox. And I find him among the more reasonable Fox radio people. So I'm happy to do his show. He's also an Illinois guy. I think he went to Northwestern. So.
And so you put on a sport coat for us today.
Well, yeah. This was for a meeting beforehand. Although, you know, for the radio, I'm not putting on a sport coat usually. Yeah,
I'd like to hear Austin's answer to the question you started the show with, John.
Right.
The odds on.
So what do you think is more likely? J.B. Pritzker becomes U.S. president. Rod Blagojevich becomes a U.S. senator. Juliana Stratton, our lieutenant governor. And by the way, she's our lieutenant governor, in case you didn't know, becomes the next U.S. senator. And for that matter, why then do J.B. and Tammy Duckworth endorse Juliana Stratton? Like, what's so marvelous about her except that she has a clean slate? There's no dirt on her because she's been invisible and hasn't been in politics for that long. But what's the upside? Some of the other people who will most likely run or would be reasonable candidates aren't terrible choices. Anyway, Austin, what's the least or most likely of those scenarios?
Stratton, most likely. Rod, least likely. Pritzker, closer to Rod than to Stratton. That's yeah, what I rank those.
Yeah, that sounds about right, yeah.
And I think it was, the anointing and how quickly there was, you know, ranks closed around Stratton was just really stunning. No one's paying attention to that race this far out. And so those kinds of endorsements are very clearly simply a message to everybody else in the state who might be thinking about running. Don't you dare think about putting your hat in the ring because the big guns are behind this person.
So, and if it does go down that path, then we're all going to get an education on who she is. She'll be popping up on our radio shows now. We'll all learn a little bit about her. But I think it's a shame if some other candidates who would be just as good, maybe better. How do you ever know if somebody's going to be good in the job that you elect them for anyway? I think a lot of people thought that Lori Lightfoot was going to be terrific. She won every single ward. And maybe we had some more red flags about the current mayor, but we didn't know it was going to be this bad, if you will, just judging by his unfavorables. So it's really hard to know, isn't it, when you elect somebody, how good they're going to be at that job anyway.
Well, you also are weighing them against the other choices in the field. So in the case of both of the mayoral candidates who won, they went through a runoff and they were pitted against one other person and you had to evaluate.
Yeah. And just one last thing about all of this. So the New York Times had a front page story about J.B. Pritzker. They described his speech in New Hampshire as having them ready to storm the gates and go out and do some disrupting. Stephen Miller actually said that it was a call to violence, what our governor was inciting when he was telling the assembled that they will know no peace and a reckoning is coming.
Well, my view of it is that it was a fairly conventional rhetorical call to protest and speak out. He talked about using megaphones, not bear spray and baseball bats and flagpoles to combat the Republicans. And you compare that to the violent rhetoric that Trump uses a lot. It's almost no contest. And, you know, I do think it would be wise if the candidates were, or the politicians were careful to try to tone down the rhetoric, but this did not strike me as anything really out of the ordinary. He was just basically calling for action and disruption, which is, I think, a code term for protest, not riots. But so the Republicans, you know, rushed to the fainting couch over this when Trump himself pardoned the people who violently attacked police officers on January 6th, which is an endorsement of violence like we've never seen before from a president.
About the current president, there was an interesting debate today or yesterday about whether or not Amazon was going to actually display on their online store the upcharge for tariffs. Maybe they were only going to do so on Amazon Haul, which was the discount site. I've not used it before, but it's been described to me that way. And they said that was an internal conversation. And now on none of their platforms will Amazon actually display the tariff. That announcement did come after the president called Jeff Bezos, and it seems like whatever was going to happen isn't going to happen, if anything was going to happen. But it looks bad now, doesn't it? So much so that now everybody's going, well, why aren't we showing the cost of tariffs? Maybe we should. There was a piece that producer Pete and I saw today, and it said, there's no way he can avoid it now. Bezos will have to display the tariff upcharges on his online store.
I think it's an example of how giving the president so much executive authority over things like tariffs gives them extraordinary power over individual businesses like Amazon. I personally think it's a great idea to put tariffs as part of the price of goods, the same way that I think it's important for things like, when you get a gallon of gasoline, those taxes should be broken out in a more clear way to show people what that money is actually going toward. I think transparency is great. It's a great way to educate people. But the problem is when you have a Congress that over decades and including now has ceded so much authority to the executive on things like tariffs, you're going to have Trump being able to call up a guy like a Bezos and say, yeah, you're not doing that or else XYZ. And I have total authority to do whatever to this massive business of yours. Now, there's in some ways that's going to be unavoidable because a business at the scale of Amazon just interacts with the federal government in so many different ways. But I think it's an example of how kind of corruption and deal making and like authority, not in the interest of an average consumer, can be wielded when the president has so much power.
You say authority. I would say bullying. But also, I found it really interesting to see that it struck a nerve with the president really quickly They were outraged by it. They know that's bad for them because we've been saying it's a consumer cost and they deny it. But there is proof, and we're going to see it. If Amazon doesn't do it, somebody else is going to. I think the floodgates are open on it. And those who have to raise prices precipitously are going to have to explain it to the consumers. And that is the explanation. And Trump has, in a way, underscored it by having such a baby fit about it. And I think the idea that he instantly called Bezos, I think that tells us that he's freaked out about the prospect.
The idea was
That's
first.
A good point. Did Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. Make your point, Kim.
I was just wondering if anyone else watched the Terry Moran interview with Trump. And I would not normally be drawn to such a thing, but having seen just one clip of it, I was drawn to it like a fly, could not resist. You can still see it, I'm sure, on YouTube and Hulu. It is worth watching that interview. And it one of the moments that is very telling is just as you were saying, Marge, he was incredibly sensitive about the suggestion from Terry Moran that tariffs were going to be a problem. Just denied it up and down. And also when Terry Moran said, you know, I was very struck by the fact that you said to Americans, you know, hang tough, there's going to be like just a little rough spot. And Trump right away was like, no, well, okay, I said that while I was campaigning, but actually things are going to be great. So he like went back and forth on that several times to the point where if I thought he was thinking about it more, I would think he was some sort of master manipulator.
Was he doing his weave? Was that
kind
the
of
weave happening?
Me around mentally to the point where I just had no idea what was going on.
The other point in that interview with the same energy was when he was confronted about the fact that our tourism is very down, and he was, you know, extraordinarily pushed back, and he looked anxious about that. And there was to me, in watching that, there seems to be a recognition and a feeling that he's kind of sitting on a very bad trade that he's just made, and he kind of needs to figure a way out of it without looking weak, because that's the numbers on tourism are going to be very bad, and the numbers on prices, depending on how this next, you know, little spell of the tariff 90-day dance goes, they are going to be entirely attributable to him, and I think he knows that.
You wonder whether he knows these things, whether the tight-knit people around him who want these tariffs to go and who want these massive cuts to government and all the things they want done from Project 2025, whether they're telling him the truth about the impact of it or whether he's surprised to find out piece by piece.
What do you think? I'm just wondering, Marge, what he doesn't know that we do. He knows the market's down. He knows that his numbers are down. I don't know what nugget of information they could possibly be withholding from him.
Well, like the tourist numbers. Is he because I don't think, you know, he's not a curious man. He doesn't read all the papers himself. He's watching Fox News. If they don't report it there, it doesn't happen as far as his world is concerned, unless he's being briefed about the day-to-day impact and details of the economy. He knows his own favorability numbers. He knows what the stock market is doing. And even that, we know Fox News isn't showing the stock ticker. I just wonder if they're withholding these details. He's not sitting for a full analysis. We're going to cut all these staff members, 100,000 people I've seen now as a number from federal government. That includes the national parks, which every employee of the national parks brings X amount of dollars back in over their salary. He probably didn't know that. Then they realized the bathrooms were all dirty and they put back people for the summer. They, you know, they're correcting these things that should have been known in advance, could have been known in advance. And I just wonder how protected he is. You know, Kate, you talk about Biden in a bubble and being protected from, you know, the public being protected from knowing his condition. I wonder how much he's in a bubble and doesn't understand the impact other than these couple of indicators.
Well, there was definitely another indicator in that interview that he is not getting a whole lot of information and pushback from his associates. Austin, you will, I'm sure, recall the portion about Kilmer
Abreu.
Garcia
Abrego Garcia.
MS-13 alleged tattoos on his hand. Listeners may recall that I think Trump tweeted a picture.
He did.
Or was holding, he was holding up a photo that was photoshopped of a hand, supposedly Garcia's hand, with MS-13 tattooed on it, but it was photoshopped. Everyone knew it was photoshopped.
Even the man that you picked out, he's got a, he said he wasn't a member of a gang. And then they looked, and right. on his knuckles, he had MS-13.
There's a dispute
over
that.
Wait a minute. He had MS-13 on his knuckles tattooed.
Oh, he had some tattoos that are interpreted that way. But let's move on.
Wait a minute. Terry.
He did not have the letter MS-13.
It says MS-13.
That was photoshopped.
That was photoshopped. Terry, you can't do that. Hey, they're giving you the big break of a lifetime. You know, you're doing the interview. I picked you because, frankly, I never heard of you, but that's okay. Terry. Hey, but you're not being very nice. He had MS-13 tattooed.
We'll agree to disagree. I want to move on to something else.
Terry, do you want me to show you the picture?
I saw the picture. Well, Here we go.
Don't Photoshop it. Go look at his hand. He had MS-13.
He did have tattoos that can be interpreted that way. I'm not an expert on them. I want to turn to Ukraine, sir.
Terry,
I want to get to Ukraine.
No. He had MS as clear as you can be, not interpreted. This is why people no longer believe the news, because
when
it's fake news.
When he was photographed in El Salvador, they aren't there. But let's just go. They aren't there when he's in El Salvador.
They're there now, right?
No, they're in your picture.
Terry.
Ukraine, sir.
He's got MS-13 on his knuckles.
All right.
Okay.
He would not let it go.
Can't we fly somebody down there and take a better picture? Because I saw another picture of this guy's hand today in the media, and it wasn't a perfect picture. I want two hands down on the table. I want pictures if for no other reason to settle this little score. Because he does have tattoos.
How about a hand holding a margarita? Would that be enough?
The pictures are out there, John. And when you look at the Photoshop picture, those aren't even tattoos. They're just like typewriter letters and little white circles that don't match his skin. Like, there's no doubt. But I disagree that Moran handled that well. Well, let's just disagree. He needed to say directly to the president, you put this out. It was not verified. It is obvious to the rest of us that those are not tattoos. It's a fake photo. The White House put it on your official channel. Something needs to be done to stop fake news from coming from your office.
Let's just stipulate that he has a gang tattoo on his knuckles and ask ourselves, we don't put people in prison in the United States for having gang tattoos or even belonging to a gang. You have to be convicted of a crime. And the idea that we took some, and like I say, let's just pretend that he is in MS-13. And I guess their evidence is extremely weak for that. But even if he were in that, you don't just take someone and ship them to another country and put them in prison there. Now, you know, if you were to somehow use due process and say, you don't, you know, we don't like your kind here, you've overstayed your welcome, whatever, and send him back to be a citizen in El Salvador again, fine. But this idea of you know, renditioning him to a prison for having gang tattoos, and again, I'm just saying for the sake of argument, that is profoundly un-American. That is, and profoundly troubling that he is digging in his heels on this, and that our courts seem impotent when it comes to enforcing their order to bring him back.
The tattoo saga is an example of why due process is so important, because the entire reason that that's even a back and forth is because everyone's trying to play out whether this guy's guilty or innocent in the court of public opinion, which is not an appropriate place to decide what to do with someone. And you saw that even in El Salvador when they were, you know, trying to put a half drunken glass on the table and things like this. It's all theatrical rather than due process in a court of law.
I want to go back for just a second to the tariff controversy with Amazon. I thought it was such a missed opportunity, just speaking about how the media, when they do get their hands on the president for an interview or one of these officials, you know, we hope that they score the point that needs to be scored, and there's a lot of missed opportunities. Scott Bessent was actually asked by the reporter.
Hi, Mr. Secretary. So it was reported this morning that Amazon will soon display a little number next to the price of each product that shows how much the Trump tariffs are adding to the cost of each product. So isn't that a perfect crystal clear demonstration that it's the American consumer and not China who is going to have to pay for these policies?
Before he could speak, and he didn't act like he wanted to speak anyway, Carolyn Leavitt steps in.
I will take this since I just got off the phone with the president about Amazon's announcement. This is a hostile and political act by Amazon. Why didn't Amazon do this when the Biden administration hiked inflation to the highest level in 40 years?
The follow-up question then was,
is here. Jeff Bezos still a Trump supporter?
And I thought, no, don't leave that point. Get an answer to the question. If Americans aren't having to bear the burden of these tariffs, if we aren't having to bear the burden of these tariffs, wouldn't a post on the online receipt demonstrate that? Wouldn't that be a way to show the American people that there's no upcharge here or that China or Amazon or somebody else is paying for it? But they let that moment slip. They walk right up to it, and then they got deflected and they didn't get back on course.
Well, they know that it's a tax. They deny that it's a tax, but it certainly just serves as a tax. I agree with Austin that we should have the fact that we pay in Chicago, we pay 70 cents a gallon in combined local, state, and federal taxes on gasoline. And so shouldn't the price at the pump, I mean, everything else, when you buy something at the store, the shelf price does not include tax. So why can't service stations advertise the price of a gallon of gas? And when you check out, you go like, oh, wow, I bought 10 gallons of gas. I got to pay $7 more to really underscore what that tax is. They want to hide that tax. I think it may be against the law, actually, even to advertise the pre-tax price on gasoline. And I remember when was it J.B. Pritzker who suspended the state gas tax for a summer, I think.
Suspended the hike.
And he wanted a sticker put on every gas pump in the state with a penalty if he didn't do it, saying that we've suspended this tiny tax and the price on the pump should increase. I'm sorry, you're right, Austin. And it was just like, look, if you're gonna make signs and talk about taxes, let's put a sticker on every pump in the state saying, If you want to calculate what the price of this gasoline is, the retail price, it's 70 cents a gallon less than it would be without the taxes. That seems fair to me, and it does seem fair to me in the same vein to say that for Amazon to say, look, you're paying 20% more on this product because it's imported from China and we have this huge tariff or whatever the number is. That seems completely fair to me. On the other hand, it is a political act because it does going to underscore something that that the administration is lying about.
Well, it's a business act. It's explaining because if somebody's prices go up 147% or even 50% to share the cost of the tariff, you're going to feel like you got to tell your customers why that happened. You're not just raking in all that extra money. So I feel like you're obligated to say, and you do see that sometimes. You'll see that a store will say, we regret the price increase, but our shipping costs have gone up, or they explain changes. Supply chain, you saw that during COVID. Everybody was saying, the reason this price went up, it's the supply chain problem. That's all I could get. Why should Trump and his tariffs be handled any differently? Because it's a business decision.
It puts the lie to their official, or at least Trump's official position. Even with Terry Moran, he was absolutely insisting still that China is going to eat these tariffs itself. So literally, they are claiming it's not going to result in higher prices because China is just going to pay it themselves and not pass it along to American consumers, which we all know is not true. And of course, this whole little kerfluffle with Amazon shows that they know it is not true. If it was true, then they wouldn't be worried about what Amazon might post. I want to see it if that happens. Maybe I'm a bad person, but I have stocked up on a few non-perishable household items.
Would you buy a lot of coffee and bananas or something?
I got quite a bit of coffee, and I got certainly some paper towels, some toilet paper, and yeah, just a few things. Eye makeup remover, just stupid things. Let's have an extra container of that around. I don't want to go around with raccoon, shadows under my eyes for 2 months if I can't get some of this.
Let me offer a consumer tip to our listeners, which is don't stock up on bananas.
Unless you have an ample freezer sort of situation.
Yeah, you can freeze them. They make great banana bread and banana cake.
I did get some coffee, so though. And then I was happy I did.
Coffee's a lot more expensive.
About how coffee was going to be a problem.
It already is in some store shelves. But I do think that there's this lag between the tariff and then those products actually getting purchased and shipped and delivered to stores, and you're seeing the increase. And that's why I'm hopeful that this grand scheme is still just a way to negotiate. They're not going to pay the full tariff, but maybe they'll meet us in the middle and it'll be 22% instead of 145%. Maybe the problem with this 100-day assessment is that's too short a period of time to assess the efficacy of something like this, if in fact that's the plan. Sure. You aim high and you settle low.
So 100 days, obviously, yes, is a very manufactured time period. Just sounds good to us. But especially when something, some policy like this hasn't even had a chance. That said, Trump is 1% ahead in approval ratings behind where he was, ahead of where he was with his first 100 days.
39%?
Something like that.
I thought it was worse, but those are all fake polls, Kate.
Oh, I forgot. Sorry. You
know, even the Fox News one was a fake poll, according to the
president. You know what, though? What did surprise me, while the overall approval numbers were all very middling, either just below 50% or maybe sometimes a tiny bit above, but more in the 30s and 40s, the Republican approval was 87%.
Yeah.
Now, Democrats, 11%.
Yeah.
And then independents with 37%. I was surprised to see how well he is still doing with his base, because I did think more Republicans were peeling away a little bit at this point.
Trump's overall approval rating was 39% in the recent Washington Post ABC Ipsos poll of 2,464 adults, compared with 55% who disapprove of how he's handling his job. By the way, Austin, I know that you've got a heart out here, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about something that the Illinois Policy Institute is writing and talking about, and that is the Chicago Teachers Union. Tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken, is May 1st. And isn't that a day that the CTU is encouraging people to engage in some sort of labor protest? Catch me up on that for a minute.
Yeah, this is becoming a trend, and I'm against the politicization of public schools no matter what your political ends are, and this is a case of that, and it's becoming part of a concerning trend in Chicago public schools, because we saw this during the primary last year, where there was an event that was sponsored by the CTU. The mm-hmm. Chicago Public Schools said, yeah, you can take your kids to this, you can take your students to this thing, and it was a political rally in favor of something on the ballot. It happened to be a tax hike. It could have been anything, and it would have been completely inappropriate because it only presented one side, and then kids were marched to the polls to go vote. And you see a similar thing here, where I'm all for civic engagement, especially for young people. I'm all for engagement on issues that matter politically, and the political conscience doesn't seem to be a great use of time when we have instructional time being used for something like this.
But are they? But I looked at the poster, Austin. Are they? And I didn't see where that, or on the online petition by CTU, them saying take kids out of school and go to this rally during the day. If an adult wanted to do it, if a teacher wanted to take a personal day or half day, they were encouraged to do so. But what is your problem with the teachers or the union getting involved?
Yeah, there is a flyer that says here's all the actions on a given day. But there's also on the CTU website instructions saying we encourage you to take students out of this. We know it's a school day, but this is important. And Chicago Public Schools is granting field trips for this.
I didn't see that. They're actually saying take the kids out of class, put them on buses or whatever, and drive them over to this rally.
Yeah, and I just think it's totally inappropriate. I think even if you are the most staunchly against this administration, it's inappropriate because using public schools in this manner in either direction is just a bad use of time for kids.
I'm trying to think of some marches or rallies, though, where we would say, I'm glad the kids were there. You know, an anti-war protest, and it's the Vietnam War, or something more contemporary. Surely mm-hmm. there must be some causes for which we would think the students would benefit were they to attend a rally or a march.
Absolutely.
No?
And students should be able to attend rallies. But where you get into a really fraught territory is when you have a government institution, especially public schools, pushing one way or the other on a given issue. And I would invite anyone who believes, you know, yes, this is a good idea because I politically believe in this cause. If it was a different political cause, would you still think this was an appropriate use?
Maybe not. But what is the cause? What is the issue that the kids are being exposed to here?
It's very broad. So I would say that it's generally just anti this administration.
Which administration? The mayor's administration?
No, the presidential administration. In line with some of the more other mass protests that we've seen, this one just happens to be more of a labor flavor because it's May Day.
Okay, so this is labor saying we don't like what Donald Trump and the administration are doing.
Yeah.
Well, now I got to think about that. Do I want my kid to be taken out of class to go to something that is saying that the administration is not good for labor? I think you could sure make that argument. That's not so fringe that maybe that's a complete waste of time.
I'm with Austin on this. I don't want my public school teachers given the liberty, and I may well agree with their position on this in this case, but I don't like the idea of schools saying we're going to take a position on a controversial issue and we're going to encourage you to take that same position and leave the classroom to exercise that. I look at it through another prism and think, well, what would I feel like if I really disagreed with what they were talking about? What if it were for example, say an anti-gay marriage rally and the school and the teachers or the school system decided that they were against gay marriage and they wanted to go out and protest against that? I would be very disturbed by that. So I think if you just say, okay, if it's okay with my politics and it's an okay thing to do, I think that's a slippery slope to get on. I'd rather the schools not do that, just like I'd like the schools not to express an opinion about religion.
Not only do I agree with you, I'm kind of surprised that it's legal for the teachers to espouse a specific political position and take the kids to a rally on its behalf. And the one that you were talking about, Austin, was that the Bring Chicago Home that they took the kids
yeah.
to vote for? Okay, that's what I thought.
Yep.
And was there no pushback that resulted from that that they couldn't do that?
What happened was we actually filed an ethics complaint because it's just plainly against the ethics code of Chicago Public Schools, and Chicago Public Schools Inspector General talked to us about it and we had conversations. And then there was really nothing done in the wake of that. And that was really, really disappointing because there just needs to be very clear guidance issued. And that needs to come from Chicago Public Schools that this is not, you know, this is not appropriate. And I would say there's a lot of rhetoric right now about against like a firewall in Chicago, safeguarding against autocracy. This would be an example of that. The public schools should have something that says we are not going to be using public school resources for things like this.
Well, this is coming from a union, and it's a pro-union or labor rally. That sort of makes sense. It's not CPS that is endorsing this. CPS, I would
they
imagine.
Are. Well, CPS has to sign off on this on field trips being an appropriate use of school time. So they are involved.
Are they going to do it then? Is that the expectation tomorrow?
There's already approved field trips for this.
Yeah. I have to ask my listeners if their students are doing that and how do they feel about that. And I wonder if, you know, without a deep dive into the principle you're talking about, people will go, it was good. Kids went to a rally and they learned a little bit about civics. That's not a bad thing.
And I would be, by the way, totally okay in a world where every parent is picking where their child is going to school, having the option of saying, oh, yeah, I actually do want to kind of customize my kid's education in this way. And I would love for them to do this for a day. The problem just becomes when it's a centralized system, when you have to go to the school that's you're zoned for, it becomes compulsory. And that's not good. That's not good.
Yeah. It seems like the kids are being used as props in two ways. You know, one, they are being indoctrinated into whatever their teachers happen to support. But then also, come on, it's a field trip that apparently they can sign up for. I don't know about you guys. I would have signed up for it.
Yeah, I know.
To get out of school.
Yeah. Until they get there and go, wait, so what? This is boring. I don't want to do this. The kids don't even get to vote. I mean, you're right. Other than as a prop, Austin, what's the value to the union for having them there? What purpose do the kids serve?
I think it's in some ways a show of force. If you're doing any kind of mass action, you want to have a lot of people there and a lot of bodies. So that's one way that can be provided, I think.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, I think it's a good civics lesson for kids. I wouldn't dismiss that idea. But I know a lot of parents who have over the years taken their kids out of school, going back to my aunt taking my cousins out in the 70s for Vietnam War protests, choosing to take their kids out of school and to attend a rally and get that lesson that they wanted them to have. And I was about to say a few minutes ago that I thought that notifying parents of the opportunity and letting them make a decision might be okay. But by the time you finished, Eric, I backed off of even that idea because there are plenty of rallies that happen for causes that I would not want my children's presence to endorse. So I don't know how this could be anything but a parental choice. And Kate, when you say, of course, you want to go for any field trip that happens
would happen
when
you're a child.
Kid.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. But the kids don't choose. The parents have to sign off on that and send them. And if they don't, they stay behind in the classroom while the rest of the class goes. And that's a problem for the child if they're left out and spend the day coloring or doing some, you know, inane workbook thing. So they've set up a poor choice, I think, for families. And here I am agreeing with Austin.
Who I think has to check out now. Austin, we're going to close the podcast today in just a couple of minutes with red light, green light, yellow light. And last week I gave a yellow light to Call My Agent, that French series, because I had watched an episode and I wasn't as into it as you all were who have seen it. Well, now I'm watching a lot of episodes. The acting is so good on that show.
Great acting. I will give a green light to an HBO show called The Rehearsal with Nathan Fielder. The second episode aired on Sunday. It is maybe the best reality television show ever. And it's called The Rehearsal.
Oh, right. The Rehearsal.
I don't know anything about it except my son told me I have to watch this. What is it?
It's really good.
Rehearsal
I would
of
say
what?
The Rehearsal is essentially Nathan Fielder, the host.
Oh, got him.
Creates very complex staged scenarios where he can learn about things. So the one for this season is around the fact that in black box recordings of plane crashes, you hear often the co-pilot saying to the pilot, they're doing something wrong. But at some point they stop telling the pilot they're doing something wrong and the plane crashes. So it's this sort of dark comedic exploration of that. And I would say the main...
That's hilarious.
Yeah, it's very fun.
Well, are you familiar with Nathan for you? Because this guy is a mind bender. Keep going,
he's
Austin.
He's mind bending. And I would say the theme of this and of Nathan for you is sociopathy. I would say is the theme of the show. And it's great.
And the prop they build and then don't need is amazing. As I understand it, I'll have to go watch it. Okay, Austin, you can click out, my friend. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
There he goes off to some other conservative media outlet now. I don't know what he's got to do.
He's like a little conservative fairy. Twinkle, twinkle, he shows up. And twinkle, twinkle, he disappears.
There's libertarian fairy dust on everything. Yeah.
What else?
The point of view we got to hear.
Amen. Do you guys like the idea of the state banning? There's legislation pending. Still needs to get through both chambers and the governor's signature, but I don't know why it wouldn't. And the idea would be that in Illinois, you could not have styrofoam containers except for anything but eggs, and single-use bags for major stores would be banned as well. So you can't get a plastic bag to carry your stuff out at Target, for instance. I'm a little disappointed they're going to take 4 years to actually roll it out, but they want to give these stores the opportunity to manage how they're going to manage it. I It was surprising to me. When we asked our listeners in a news click about it, it was like 55-45. I thought it would be 90-10. I don't know why people wouldn't endorse or support this idea. It's a little convenient, I guess, to get a bag at Target. And how many of us have gone into a store and forgotten our reusable bag, and then we had to pay 10 cents for one in Chicago? But I'm all on board. Are you all on board, too?
You can still get a paper bag, right?
You could get a paper bag. And maybe energy-wise and environmental-wise, that might be a push. It might not be that much better for the world if somebody has a paper mill and then they generate all of the water waste and everything else that goes into making a paper bag.
I think that you are right to suggest that it is a push, the paper bag versus plastic bag. I've certainly read studies about that where, you know, make paper bags, first of all, they're heavier to transport, so they require more fossil fuels to get them to the store. And of course, you're cutting down forests, and there's a lot of water involved in making paper. So there's a bit of folklore involved in the fact that plastic bags are so much worse than paper bags. I think the current system with bags, where they charge a dime for a bag that you use, paper or plastic, is the one that makes the most sense under those conditions. And I don't like it when I forget my bags, and I try to like stuff the bag as full as I can. It's ridiculous. It's a dime, you know. But I think it's a good idea. I think it's a reminder every time you go into the store to be efficient with your bags. The styrofoam containers thing, I think those are overused, given that you don't really have to keep. They're used a lot for leftovers, you know, doggy bags, as they used to call it. And I don't think it's all that important to keep that food hot. And so I think that the cardboard shells that a lot of places have should suffice. So I'd be in favor of the styrofoam, and I'm opposed to the plastic bag.
I am not sure about what the real downstream effects are. I'm not sure how this is different from the city outlawing single-use bags, which simply resulted in stores instead investing in heavier bags, which are not single-use bags because they're thick enough to keep reusing them. So I think it's probably kind of a pointless law. I think what would make sense is like what you said, Eric.
10 cents.
The amount of money you pay for bags and really what they should do. We've had 10 cents for a long time now, and people have just kind of gotten used to it. It's probably not enough to really deter enough people to make that switch to their own bags.
It should be
probably
more.
It's time to up the price of the bags.
That's what I'm thinking, Kate. How much? Yeah. What do you think would be sufficiently persuasive to people that they really would stop wasting all these single-use bags?
50 cents.
Yeah.
I'd start with 50 cents a bag.
Make it a dollar. Nobody would have to pay it.
You could. Okay. All right, let's do it, King. Let's do it, King John.
By the way, people lie about it anyway, because when I go to the store, it says, how many bags are you purchasing? And then I enter the number, and then it puts 10, 20, 30 cents on my bill. Well, if you put zero and you take 15 bags, there's no bag police. Nobody in the history of my grocery store experience has ever come up and said, sir, can I see your receipt? There's no enforcement of it.
There is at regular checkout. For self-checkout, there isn't much of one, and it is kind of a form of shoplifting. I think a dollar is way too much.
I'm surprised at you.
I think a quarter is about right. I think that would be much more. I mean, I would hate for it to be a dollar, because I do occasionally run into stores and I don't have a bag, and like I say, I don't care to pay 10 cents for it, but I feel like, well, this is my little contribution to making the world less littered.
To be realistic, you would stop doing that if you had to pay a dollar.
Yeah, you'd remember, mister.
You really would keep that bag with you.
Or I might skip the shopping trip and wait till I'm home. I would probably be more diligent about just having a stash of bags in my car, too. That would be a better.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, I'm terrible. I buy bags all the time.
Yeah.
I do. So I know, 10 cents, it's not doing it for me.
But 10 cents, it's only been 10 cents for a little while. It was 7 cents up until.
Yeah, it was.
Well, what about styrofoam?
Styrofoam is horrible. There's no doubt about it. But what are you going to require that they use instead? Is it better or worse? That's really what I kind of need to know.
That's their problem. I mean, they're in the industry of selling food, and somebody's in the business of providing them a container to take it home, and that's not my problem. It's our problem
if we want to improve the environment. It's our problem. We want to actually pass a policy that's going to improve the situation, not make it worse.
If you said no styrofoam, there'd be no styrofoam, and then they would have to come up with plan B, and it would be cardboard or a...
And then we wait and see if that's worse. And if it is, we pass another law.
Maybe so.
I'd like to suggest that the timing for doing something about styrofoam, which to me is more of a concern than paper bags, the timing is probably good because I think all that stuff or a lot of it is made in China. Certainly the non-recyclable plastic is.
Yeah.
It's about to get very expensive. And there are excellent cardboard options that some restaurants use. Mm-hmm. And I think it's time to urge them to switch and give them a little push with a state law that forces them into something that would be cheaper and, to President Trump's point, probably could be made in this country.
But another pet peeve of mine along these lines is that in Chicago, if you order takeout or if the food is delivered to you, they're not supposed to put any of the plastic forks and plates and cups unless you ask for it. And that is completely ignored as well. If you go to Portillo's and get something to go, they'll fill it with a bunch of stuff that you probably won't use because you're taking it home. And maybe you won't use this stuff. Now you've got that one drawer with all of those things that you hate to throw away, but you never seem to use. And they're not supposed to be doing that. Sometimes the amount of waste that you get with your takeout food is discouraging to me. It's like nobody's paying any attention. Nobody cares.
Even if you check on an online order, I say no utensils, and half the time they're in my bag.
I didn't even notice that, Marge. There's a thing you can click.
A lot of time.
Yeah.
A lot of restaurants do. I think they're supposed to all, but a lot of them do. And I'll just add one more thing. This is a state that could never pass a bottle bill. Like, we have a lot of things that we could do to improve the waste.
What's a bottle bill?
You know, to put make them all returnable and have a 10 cent or so extra tax on them that you get back if you return the bottle.
Gosh, do states
we
do that?
I was going to say,
we used to do
that. A lot of states do that, and Illinois doesn't do it.
Wait a minute. So if I buy a soda, are you talking about like soda bottles and things like
that? Yeah, if you buy a soda in the state of Michigan, which was one of the first ones to do it, in the early 80s, Michigan did it. You pay an extra, I don't know, it's 10 cents, 8 cents, something like that, on the can or bottle. And then if you keep it and take it back to the store, they will give you your 10 cents back.
Oh.
My kids, when we go, you know, on vacation, they like to collect them. The grandkids now do that, you know. And
go get some money.
It is such a hassle. I tell you, as a Michigan, former Michigander who visits Michigan a lot, it's a hassle. I love my environment, but boy, returning those bottles, I don't even do it. I mean, I'll buy a bottle of Mountain Dew or something like that on my way to Ann Arbor, and I'll just toss the bottle out.
Oh, you are so bad.
People go to the
recycle
Oasis, or they don't call them that in Michigan. They go to the rest stops and they pull cans and bottles out of the trash and make a little money for people for whom that dime actually.
But they do sell plastic soda containers, right? Like you get a plastic bottle of soda.
You pay the deposit on that too.
Mm-hmm. You do.
Yeah.
And you know, I do think Illinois should bring that back. And Illinois used to have this way before Michigan, because we had it when I was a little kid. This was one of the ways as a little kid you made money. And for sure, there are people who go up and down my alley picking up things like this. And this would be another thing that they could pick up and make a little money off of.
Well, that didn't happen anymore, though, right?
I'm not sure when Illinois stopped doing it.
Okay, we're going to do red light, green light, and yellow light. Austin gave us his suggestion of something that he's enjoying, the rehearsal, the Nathan Fielder show. I've watched the Nathan Fielder stuff in the past. It's the most innovative TV you'll ever see, and he's such a curious personality. And I struggle a little bit with the ethics of what he's doing sometimes. Is he duping people and you know, making them the object of some derision? Is he an object of derision? Is the joke on him? It's really hard to figure out.
I'm going to green light the Substack from Robert Hubble, two B's, two L's. My inbox is full of various analyses of the political landscape, as you can imagine, and a lot of them are doomsayers. Midas, I'm backing off from a little bit because they're so self-congratulatory. I'm glad they're number one, and that's great, but tell me what the news is. I'd rather see that. Heather Cox Richardson is an old standard, and she's great, but long. Hubble mixes the things that you need to pay attention to and be worried about with some positive stuff that shows that the resistance is working in some ways. He is encouraging to keep doing what people are doing, to whether it's lawsuits or getting out in the street or making calls. He's encouraging to the people who are doing actions and get a little frustrated and overwhelmed by the avalanche of negative stories, and he's got good balance. So I'm going to recommend him. Green light.
This is the time of year where it occurs to me, I highly recommend that people think about ordering regular deliveries from local farms for produce. A colleague of mine from The Reader, Vera Vodanovich, has a family farm in Southwest Michigan, bringing produce from her family farm sometimes to the farmers markets, etc. And this year, she specifically is doing boxes of food, and her produce just looks so gorgeous. So I signed up for an August box from Vera's farm. There are many farms that do this. So I'm sure when Vera's orders are up, you could easily Google around and find another organic or non-organic,
yeah, the
organic farm in the area.
The term to look for is CSA, Community Supported Agriculture.
Okay.
My green light is for a podcast called The Parole Room. The host is Ben Austin, is local journalist here, and it's produced by Bill Healy, who is the producer of Mary Schmeek's wonderful podcast series that's just out. But The Parole Room is about the system of parole in Illinois, which still exists, even though parole was abolished, I think, in the late 70s in Illinois. There's still a bunch of these superannuated prisoners who are looking to be released by the parole board. And it talks all about the case of Johnny Veal, who was convicted in the murder of a couple of police officers. He says he didn't do it. And it's a wonderful, wonderful podcast, and explains a lot about the justice system and about, you know, who's behind bars and why. Unfortunately, it's an Audible product, so you have to be an Audible account holder to listen to it. But it's great piece of work, The Parole Room.
That's Eric Zorn and Kate Pleiss and Marge Halperin. Austin clicked out. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman, and we will drop another pod on you next week.
Okay.
Does anybody watch The Pitt, by the way, on HBO?
It's the best show
ever. I don't watch medical shows.
It's very medical, but Noah Wiley's... Oh, he's terrific in that, right, Eric? Is that what you think?
I haven't seen it. People have been recommending it to me.
People are going nuts about it. I'm almost thinking about watching a little of it, but I do hate medical shows.
Johanna's not into them either, so I don't know if we're going to do that. So.
Well, let me know. Okay, right. Guys, we'll see you around.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.